Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 27th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, speciation by natural and sexual selection, making sense of the medieval climate anomaly and Little Ice Age, and following the stimulus funding for science in the United States. All this, plus we read from your letters to Science Magazine.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands are all about the same size, and vary mostly, or rather very most importantly, in the sizes and shapes of their beaks, which are well adapted to the different food sources on the islands. This kind of speciation, called sympatric speciation, develops even without a geographic barrier to separate groups. And scientists have been puzzling over how one or more new species can evolve from a common species without that geographic separation. In a paper published online by Science, Sander van Doorn and colleagues report their solution to that puzzle, a mathematical model that combines natural selection with sexual selection, or choosiness. I spoke with van Doorn from his office at the University of Bern in Switzerland.
So we had many ecological models of speciation, and they have been actually quite good in explaining why species would diverge and then would occupy different ecological niches and would evolve ecological specializations. But they have not really addressed why species would also evolve reproductive isolation, so kind of mechanisms that would avoid gene flow between species. And this has been addressed in another kind of model for sympatric speciation, sexual selection models, which then specifically look at mate choice and mating preferences. And they are very good in explaining how you can get reproductive isolation, but they do not really explain the coexistence of species. And for that, you need ecological specialization. So kind of the thing that was missing all the time was integrating these two viewpoints on speciation in a single model.
How exactly does your team's model then differ from previous models?
Well, one of the things that is different is that we look at both ecology and sexual selection within the same context, within the same mathematical model. And this has also been done by other authors before, but it's kind of relatively rare that you do that. So you usually try to keep things as simple as possible. And then to include both sexual selection and ecology makes things rather complicated. So theoreticians like to avoid that. Another issue that is kind of new to our approach is that we look at a specific interaction between ecology and mate choice, and that is that we assume that the signals that males use to attract mates, that they give some information about the extent to which the male is adapted to the ecological conditions. And this is a kind of more specific type of interaction between ecology and mate choice that nobody had looked at before, even though it's very straightforward. And if you talk to field biologists, it's something that they would always kind of agree on, that that's a very prevalent thing in nature, that, for example, male ornaments that are used in sexual selection, that they give some information about the condition of the male, and the condition of a male is then presumably also reflective of the extent to which he is adapted to the local conditions.
So could sympatric speciation in your team's model occur without the parameters for sexual selection?
Yes. So in this case, we look at this kind of ecological context that calls for specialization. So we have basically two different ecological opportunities that the species can explore and exploit. And if these two different ecological opportunities are sufficiently different, and if there is not a lot of migration between two habitats where these two ecological conditions exist, then you can have speciation without sexual selection. But the problem is that for that to happen, you need rather extreme parameter conditions. So you need basically almost separated habitats with almost no exchange of individuals between the two places, and also very strong selection within each habitat, so that there is a very strong disruptive selection on the species to split. So you can have ecological speciation just by itself, but the problem is that you require very extreme conditions for that to work. And most biologists wouldn't think that would be very realistic.
Not exactly sympatric.
Yeah, that's another problem. You need kind of two separated habitats without a lot of traffic of individuals between the two. So that wouldn't exactly be sympatric, that's right.
Now, you said what prompts the sexual selection is some sort of ornamentation, brighter colors of plumage, say, that indicates they're better adapted to the environment.
Yes.
But couldn't it be that the offspring of the better adapted parent are just simply better adapted and so more likely to survive and reproduce themselves? It's not sexual selection at all?
Yeah, so that's certainly an effect that plays a role. So if you choose a partner that is locally adapted, then you're also more likely to produce offspring that's locally adapted. On the other hand, if you choose a partner that's not locally adapted, you're more likely to produce offspring that has kind of an intermediary ecological phenotype that doesn't do well in either habitat, so then your offspring will be selected against and will have low fitness. So that's part of the reason of why this process is so powerful, that kind of the ecological context has kind of severe fitness consequences, so they kind of put severe fitness consequences on kind of wrong mate choice decisions. And this is why we get such strong selection on mate choice to actually make sure that you choose the right partner. So in this sense, there's an interaction between ecology and mate choice that drives the whole process, and that's a crucial part. You will get a kind of positive feedback between the two going that then results in very strong selection.
So this choosiness, this behavior of choosing a mate based on some outward expression of natural fitness, that
yes.
mate choice or sexual selection, it evolves right alongside the natural or ecological selection for some advantageous characteristic?
Exactly. So there is this disruptive selection on the ecological characters of an individual, and that somehow then translates into increased attractiveness if your ecological phenotype fits with the local conditions. And since it's so important to choose a partner that kind of fits with the local conditions, it also becomes very important for the females to involve preferences where they recognize the phenotype of locally adapted males. So basically, the ecological conditions create selection pressures on the mate choice characters, and they create the sexual selection pressures that then lead to strong choosiness. And once you have strong choosiness, then that reinforces the natural selection. So if females only want to mate with locally adapted mates, then that kind of reinforces the disruptive ecological selection that was there already, and that can then split the gene pool in two parts.
Are there ways that you and your team would have wanted to improve this model further that you just didn't have time or processing power to do?
Well, one of the things that we've been thinking about quite a bit, also after talking to other biologists about this idea, is to think about what would happen if individuals not just make mate decisions based on the single ornament, but if there are multiple aspects of attractiveness that they could base their decision on. And this is something that many biologists are now interested in, this issue of multiple ornaments or complex sexual displays. And that could be a way where that would allow for diversification also of sexual preferences and ornamentations between the two species. And that's something that we would want to look at in the future to see whether this kind of process could actually lead to the divergence of mating preferences between species as well.
Well, Sander van Doorn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sander van Doorn of the University of Bern is lead author of a paper on the origin of species by natural and sexual selection. Find it online at www.scienceexpress.org. Before people started recording temperatures, before even the invention of the thermometer, various indicators of how warm or cold it was on Earth were recorded, and still are, in tree rings, coral reefs, ice cores, or what scientists call proxy data. Past research showed how this proxy data could be used to reconstruct global temperatures of the past, but as more and more data is collected, scientists are able to get more and more specific, reconstructing regional temperatures of the past. In a paper in this week's Science, Michael Mann and colleagues present their model of the regional climate of the past, which includes the Little Ice Age of about the 17th to 19th centuries and the medieval climate anomaly, somewhere between the 9th to 13th centuries. The model may have implications for the next assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, because it shows the tropical Pacific acts as a kind of thermostat to regulate, somewhat, the global climate, a mechanism that isn't part of many modern climate models. I spoke with Mann from his office at Pennsylvania State University.
So much emphasis has been put on the use of proxy data to look at, say, how the average temperature of the Earth has changed in the past. And that may be an interesting question from the point of view of framing the recent warming and determining whether it's unusual and related, in fact, to human activity on the climate. But it turns out that a lot of what we can learn from the paleoclimate record that's much more likely to really inform our understanding of climate change impacts, in particular what the regional impacts of human-caused climate change are likely to be. There are uncertainties in that question right now. There are uncertainties in how wind patterns and drought patterns and regional temperature patterns will change in response to increasing greenhouse gas concentrations, because there are remaining uncertainties in the climate models that we use to make those projections. And they don't all agree on certain important questions, like how will the El Nino phenomenon change in the future. We can actually address those sorts of questions from the paleoclimate record as well, and that's what this paper is really about.
So what type of climate patterns are there in your team's model of the past that also appear in the more recent climate record, where there is temperature data, not proxy data?
Right. So the leading patterns of variation over the globe in surface temperature patterns during the last century or century and a half, during the instrumental interval, are observed to relate to phenomena that are quite familiar. The leading pattern of variation is related to the large-scale warming. It's sort of the global warming pattern. But as you look at the other patterns that contribute a significant amount of variability to the record, the El Nino phenomenon is a very prominent pattern as expressed in the global surface temperature record. It's associated with, of course, a warming in the eastern and central tropical Pacific, but there are influences around the surface of the Earth. And so there's a global pattern of influence of the El Nino phenomenon, or its converse, the La Nina phenomenon, and that is also expressed in the surface temperature record. There's another somewhat less known phenomenon that is, in fact, quite relevant to those of us who live in North America or Europe. That's the so-called North Atlantic Oscillation, or sometimes it's called the Arctic Oscillation, and it's essentially a flip-flop in the pattern of the Northern Hemisphere jet stream from one year to the next, and it oscillates on timescales of years, decades, and in fact, centuries as well. And that influences regional temperature patterns over a large part of North America, a large part of Eurasia, and that also expresses itself fairly prominently in the set of leading surface temperature patterns.
Now, as the title of your team's paper makes note, the time period that you and your team analyzed includes the Little Ice Age and the Medieval Climate Anomaly.
Right.
When are those periods? And according to your team's model, what happened?
So the complication sometimes in defining those periods is that, unlike the recent warming of the past century, past periods of warming or cooling tend to be very heterogeneous regionally. That means that if one region was relatively warm, there's a good chance that other regions were cold and vice versa. Because of that, it means that it's actually somewhat of a challenge to define in a global sense the Little Ice Age or the medieval climate anomaly. What used to be called the medieval warm period, most scientists favor now the use of the term the medieval climate anomaly for the reason that I just cited, that it wasn't warm everywhere. And that's very clear in our own reconstructions. So these intervals are a challenge to define because they are so spatially variable regionally. The warming and cooling happens in different places and different times. But if you look at, say, the average temperature over the Northern Hemisphere, there is a period of somewhere between the 9th century and the 13th century where temperatures were relatively warm compared to subsequent centuries. And in fact, a period during the 17th century to the 19th century or somewhere about there, where temperatures averaged over the Northern Hemisphere were relatively cool in comparison with that medieval period. But if you look at the medieval period, even though it was relatively warm compared to that Little Ice Age, it compares in a global sense at most with the level of warming that we saw in the mid-20th century. It doesn't reach the levels of warmth that we've seen in the most recent decades, at least globally. So we used those two intervals characterizing overall when it was relatively cool and relatively mild, averaged over the Northern Hemisphere, to define the intervals that we would call the medieval climate anomaly and the subsequent Little Ice Age. And then we looked at the spatial patterns of those time intervals.
What aspects, then, more precisely, of your team's model of the past may help in predicting current climate change?
Well, there are really two very interesting observations in the reconstructed patterns that we were actually able to test against climate model predictions. And so we took those same periods, that medieval climate anomaly period and the Little Ice Age period, and we know, imperfectly, but we have some idea of what the level of natural factors that influence climate in the past. We sort of know what those factors were. We have a good idea of how the output of the sun has varied over the past 1,000 years, although there's some uncertainty. We have a fairly detailed record of the history of explosive volcanic eruptions. And so these are two natural factors contrasting, for example, with the human factor of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. These are natural factors that influence climate over time. And we took those factors and we ran two different climate models with the estimated difference in the levels of volcanism and solar output in those two different intervals, in the medieval climate anomaly and the Little Ice Age period. One of the models is the NCAR-coupled model. The other model we used was the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies-coupled model. So it gave us sort of a sampling of two different physical representations of the way the climate system responds to these natural factors. And we could look at both of those models. We could see what they predicted, and we could see how it compared with what we actually observed. And what we observed was that the surface temperature patterns during the medieval era counterintuitively look more like the La Niña phenomenon when it's cold in the eastern and central tropical Pacific. Now, this is a period of time when solar output was relatively high. There was relatively little explosive volcanism. So there was a net heating of the global climate. It was a relatively warm interval. And yet those same factors appear to have drove the climate not into the warm El Niño state of the tropical Pacific, but the cold La Niña state, a bit counterintuitive. We also saw in the reconstructed pattern that when you compare the medieval era to the Little Ice Age era, aside from the medieval era actually being cooler in the tropical Pacific, counterintuitively, what we used to think of the medieval warm period is that was actually cold in the tropical Pacific in comparison with the Little Ice Age, which is what we normally think of as the cold period.
So this is the idea of the tropical Pacific acting as a thermostat.
Absolutely. And we see that in the reconstructions. As it turns out, neither of the two models that we looked at actually exhibit that response. There are only a relatively small subset of coupled climate models that exhibit this tropical thermostat response. Most of the models do the opposite. When you warm the tropical Pacific, the models respond with an El Niño-like state. And when you cool the tropical Pacific, they respond with a La Niña like state. So the majority of the models used in the most recent IPCC projections, for example, don't favor the thermostat response. They favor an El Niño-like response to a warming of the surface, like the warming that we're seeing with increased greenhouse gas concentrations. However, the paleoclimate record of the past 1,000 years, in our analysis, suggests that at least with respect to the response that the climate has exhibited to natural factors, the response appears to be that thermostat response. It appears to be the opposite of what most of the IPCC projection models project.
So is it your team's intention then to try to get your model included in the next assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC?
Well, the two models...
the NCAR and NASA ones are already in there.
Yeah. But exactly. So I think that it's useful. And in the next IPCC assessment, it may very well be the case that there will be a new section that deals with the question of how paleoclimate data can inform our understanding of some of these fairly complex dynamical responses of the climate. So while I don't see our results as being made explicitly part of an IPCC projection, I do see them as potentially informing our assessment of the extent to which we think the current generation models are or are not capturing some of the regional mechanisms that may be important in making regional climate change assessments.
Michael Mann, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Michael Mann of Pennsylvania State University is lead author of a paper on the global signatures and dynamical origins of the Little Ice Age and medieval climate anomaly.
This package looks at what was an unprecedented level of funding for basic research in the United States.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis reports and edits a package of stories in this week's issue that follows the $18 billion U.S. dollars in stimulus funding set aside for science agencies in the United States.
It grows out of a bill that was passed by Congress and signed by President Obama in February called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, but it goes by the name of the stimulus because that's how people see it. In the midst of the recession, this was supposed to stimulate the economy. And the twist was that research was included. So it wasn't just building roads, putting people back to work. It was also looking ahead at the value of research in helping the economy in the long run. So within that $18 billion, NIH, National Institutes of Health, received more than half of that. The National Science Foundation received $3 billion. And DOE's Office of Science received $2 billion. And so these stories look at how each of the agencies decided to spend that money and what the results were. We also did a story on a decision by Congress to spend $1.1 billion on a controversial area called comparative effectiveness research. This funds studies on what types of medical procedures and treatments are most effective. And supporting research in this topic is controversial, and one of the articles in the package looks at the reasons why.
Before we get to that, any money going to a scientific agency might be called stimulus. So what in particular are the big three science agencies doing to meet the goals of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act?
Right. Well, Congress was very concerned that the money be spent quickly. Completely by the end of the 2010 fiscal year, which is September 2010, most of the agencies, though, interpreted it to be spent even more quickly by the end of the 2009 fiscal year, which was this past September. And so they designed a process where they could get the money out as quickly as possible. For the Department of Energy and for NSF, that was pretty much taking what was already in-house, whether it was an individual research proposal or a facility that had gotten high reviews and that was considered important research or an important facility, and green-lighting it. In other words, proposals that there hadn't been enough money to fund in the past, and now there was, thanks to the Stimulus Act. NIH did that also, but they added a wrinkle that caused a stir in the community. In addition to pumping up existing grants and increasing success rates, they held two new competitions, which generated more than 25,000 proposals. That's a huge amount of work by the community. So in the case of biomedical research, the scientists had to do quite a bit of work before they could enjoy the fruits of their labor. Everyone is happy that so much money was available, but the success rates at NIH were very low. In other words, the odds of getting money were as low as 2 or 3 or 4% for the new competitions because they generated such an overwhelming response.
Well, you said everybody's happy. Any concerns then in the scientific community of how the money is being spent by any of the agencies?
Well, I think there are two issues, one short-term and one long-term. The short-term issue, of course, was can it be spent well? And I think the agencies bulletproofed themselves pretty well by saying these are proposals that we have already looked at. In the case of DOE, these were projects, facilities, instruments, buildings that they had already said they wanted to fund that perhaps they had begun to fund, but they didn't have nearly enough money to fund them fully. This money gave them that opportunity, and so it was pretty clear what the purpose was, what the value was, and what you would get out of that. The second issue, of course, is the long-term impact, and that's where, in the case of NIH, who got the $10 billion thanks in large part to Senator Arlen Specter, who has been a longtime advocate for biomedical research, he said, I don't want you to just spend it on the same things. I want something novel. And that's why NIH did the two new competitions, so that they could expand their portfolio. And it would all be high-quality research, but it would some of it would be in areas that they hadn't previously funded. And that's what Congress was looking for, in addition to making sure the money was well spent. They wanted some new ideas. They wanted some high-risk proposals that would have potentially high payoffs. Another portion of the money that DOE got was to fund a new agency called the Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy. And that is specifically to, as Secretary Stephen Chu calls it, to try to hit a few home runs, to really tackle the issue of moving to a low-carbon economy, of a sustainable, renewable energy sources that require big ideas, some of which will fail, but that are worth investigating. That's something that agencies traditionally just don't have the money to do. The stimulus package gave them not just the money, but the authority to pursue those.
What about the sustainability, though, of these various projects once the funding runs out?
That's, of course, the big question. Everybody refers to going off the cliff, and the money will run out. Some of the grants were for 4 or 5 years, so it won't run out in 2010 necessarily. But it has increased the portfolio, the capabilities of universities to do research. It's increased the mortgages, as it were, that agencies have. And it's very unclear how much their budgets will grow in the future. President Obama has promised to double budgets for NSF, for DOE's Office of Science, and for another agency, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. But even that is a promise that you can't take to the bank until Congress appropriates the money. NIH has suffered for several years of very small budgets that haven't kept up with inflation. So this surge of money has raised the question of whether this is going to be a roller coaster ride and whether they will crash after it's spent. It depends, as everything else, on what Congress decides year to year to do with the budget. Given the recession, given the growing concern about the deficit, 2011 is probably going to be a very tough year, and that increases the concerns of the academic community.
Now, back to that controversial topic of funding, the $1.1 billion going to comparative evaluation of medical treatments. What more precisely is it, and what's the controversy?
Okay. What it attempts to do is to look very rigorously at the evidence for and against any particular standard of care, whether that's mammography, CAT scans, or other types of treatments for any disease, and look at whether the benefits of that treatment warrant the cost. The big concern is that these treatments, that we're spending a lot of money for treatments that aren't effective or that may be harmful to people by exposing them to dangerous radiation or subjecting them to unnecessary surgeries and other treatments that are not warranted by their condition.
This is seen perhaps as second-guessing a doctor?
Yes. And also what the federal government would pay for under Medicare and Medicaid. It's a question of holding the treatments up to a light of rigorous scientific scrutiny and seeing if they pass.
How is Congress addressing this controversy? What are they doing? What steps are they taking?
Well, what they've done is they've explicitly prohibited the results from the research coming that's funded by the stimulus package from being used to set federal guidelines. In other words, they have left it up to the agency to decide what to do with the results that come from the research that's being funded from the stimulus money.
that kind of data is going to be, from an economic standpoint, hard to pass up, especially if it comes to a government-sponsored insurance plan, wouldn't it?
I think that's the reason for doing it. But as with everything else in medicine and in science, there's a political aspect that has to also be taken into consideration. And that's what Congress was saying when it said, we want this information, but we're still going to set the final policy.
Jeffrey Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Jeffrey Mervis on the package of stories in this week's issue that follows the $18 billion U.S. dollars in stimulus funding set aside for science agencies in the United States. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to the August 28th editorial, Great Teachers for STEM. In that editorial, Maxine Singer suggests several solutions for cultivating teachers of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM, courses. In the November 6th issue, John Dickey from Puerto Rico writes in to suggest that implementing Singer's suggestions, at least in the United States, will require a cultural shift.
Dickey writes, although the United States needs more young scientists to go into pre-college science teaching, insufficient numbers will do so if they are obliged to abandon their own adventures in science. As with college professors, we should enable and expect 7th to 12th grade science teachers to participate regularly and significantly in scientific research. Sustained research activity, not just workshops or tag-along excursions, should be part of the opportunity and responsibility of a science teacher.
Our next letter comes from the November 20th issue and is in response to Donald Granberg's book review titled Two Doors and a Goat.
The book that's reviewed is called The Monty Hall Problem, The Remarkable Story of Math's Most Contentious Brain Teaser, and is by Jason Rosenhaus. In The Monty Hall Problem, you are shown three identical doors. Behind one of them is a car. The other two conceal goats. You are asked to choose but not open one of the doors. After doing so, Monty, who knows where the car is, opens one of the two remaining doors. After opening an incorrect door, Monty gives you the option of either switching to the other unopened door or sticking with your original choice. You then receive whatever is behind the door you choose. What should you do?
In his November 20th letter, Simon LeVay from California writes in response, "The answer Granberg offers to the Monty Hall problem is incorrect. He assumes that the contestant should try to win the car. In reality, a car pollutes the environment and adds nothing to the car the contestant already owns. In contrast, a goat replaces noisy lawnmowers and provides milk, cheese, and, if absolutely necessary, a tasty curry."
Our next letter is about teaching strategies and is in response to the July 31st News Focus story, Reshuffling Graduate Training, by Jeffrey Mervis. Both the news article and the letters written in response include suggestions to empower graduate students and make them more independent by directly awarding them government fellowships and grants.
Michael Town from the French Laboratory of Glaciology and Geophysics of the Environment writes in to suggest instead that training current and future principal investigators to effectively manage graduate students would improve the efficiency of the science industry.
Town writes, although academic culture recognizes the importance of graduate students, it currently does almost nothing to train current students and future principal investigators to effectively manage this resource. Few PhDs have substantial hands-on experience managing others before they land a faculty position, and even fewer have any formal training in management. Faculty are left to learn this skill on the job at the expense of productivity and the well-being of the people they are managing.
Furthermore, Town continues, there is an emphasis on student independence in this discussion, which is natural. Independence is an essential quality in a career researcher. The unfortunate implication is that ideal students are independent from the start. In fact, independence is a skill that can be taught and nurtured, just like the other skills that are explicitly taught in graduate school.
Town concludes, unproductive students are a consequence of student inexperience and poor advising. Better management of students can be achieved through a range of mechanisms that involve both faculty and students. Such efforts may cost time initially, but will certainly pay off in the long run.
You can read Towne's full letter in the November 20th issue of Science. The last letter this month is also about education, this time about teaching strategies. P.D. Boersma from the University of Washington in Seattle and Lynn Zerflew, Professor Emeritus from Western Washington University, write in response to a September 4th letter by R. Hoffman and S. Y. McGuire, titled Teaching and Learning Strategies That Work.
The authors write, in the letter, two chemistry professors described educational strategies they have developed over the course of their 40 years of combined teaching experience. We were struck by the fact that they made no obvious reference to the discipline of education. In the past 40 years, there have been thousands of research studies documented in the education literature. These research studies detail and inform us of the successes and failures of teaching strategies and their impact on the learner at all stages of development.
The authors continue, colleges of education within universities are grounded in research and a body of literature on teaching and learning. All professors wishing to teach should be informed by past research in education, just as we expect chemists to be informed by past research in chemistry. Why is it that professors who earn doctoral degrees in other disciplines automatically presume to be teachers?
The authors conclude, unfortunately, this approach is rampant in academia and even in this journal's sister publication, Science Signaling. Upon review of the 57 abstracts, going back to 2003, that Science Signaling lists as teaching resources, not one was written by an educator. We will see improvements in teaching sooner if we are informed by research on teaching strategies proven to maximize learning across all developmental levels.
You can find the letter in this week's issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back next week. In the meantime, you can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For now, that wraps up the November 27th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.